Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Crew Call with Mike Rose. This is the October 2020 edition, volume 2-10. And my guest tonight is Jerry Schaefer. How you doing, Jerry?
I'm well, Mike. It's good to hear from you.
Well, you know, Jerry's one of these guys that I see every once in a New England meet. And since we didn't have one this year, we were sort of chatting back and forth, probably on Facebook. And we tended to have some wide-ranging discussions, but I think the main thing that I'm interested in everybody knowing more about Jerry tonight is his extensive modeling experiences. It's not the only thing Jerry does. He's a musician and an author and an all-around Renaissance kind of man. But when I first met Jerry, he was at his clinic on God only knows what that was. You're going to fill me in on that. But I know I was impressed with it. I was impressed enough with it that I think I went up and talked to you after your presentation. No doubt it was something Penn Central, correct?
Likely, yeah. Yeah, we probably had a Penn Central Conrail conversation that was wide-ranging and went down a bunch of rabbit holes.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I mean, I cut my teeth on Penn Central. I mean, as a kid, it was New Haven, but very quickly became Penn Central down here. And that Penn Central's the first thing I modeled. And I can remember taking, black, undecorated plastic Atheron locomotives and putting champ decals on them with no setting fluid and wondering why it looked so bad. And, kind of all went from there.
Where's down here for you? I don't even really know.
I'm in southeastern Massachusetts.
Right, okay.
Yeah. And you are somewhere in the Great White North.
Yeah, I'm near Toronto, like Hamilton, Steel Town.
Oh.
It's kind of the Pittsburgh of Canada.
I spent some very, very happy hours at Bayview Junction back in the day. We had like idyllic weather and lots of trains and, you know, that dramatic brake smoke coming off the brake shoes when they were coming down from the north into the junction. And it just... what a spot. Loved it.
I spent a lot of time there as a kid with my dad. And then when I became a teenager and I had my own car, I had a good friend who lived really close to walking distance to Bayview. So
nice.
We spent a lot of time there. We were spoiled. I really had no idea how good we had it back then.
I know, huh?
I traveled around.
Well, there's nothing like the beginning to start at. So how did you get into trains?
Dad was he worked for CNR, not for very long, but he was a maintenance guy.
Ah.
And then he left the railway because of the hours just weren't conducive to having, you know, family life for him. And he left the railway in a time when you could, in Hamilton, you could quit your job on Friday night and have a new job on Monday. And
wow.
It would be a good paying, you know, industrial sector job at one of the big factories, be National Steel Car and Stelco and DeFasco and all of the, you know, support industries for that. So that's how, you know, like Dad was a railroader and knew how to talk to railroaders. And so... you know, didn't have a lot of money. So entertaining, you know, his kid, we'd go out and watch trains and I just, you know, I kind of got hooked.
And you had no problem with access?
Well, no, he could talk his way into anywhere. Like he just, you know, he presented like a railroader, you know, as opposed to presenting like a train buff or rail fan,
right,
whatever you want to call it. I don't know which ones. I think railfan is pejorative now, I think. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think it probably is among the professionals. I know that when I was a kid, we would go down to New Bedford Yard and you could just walk right in there and I would stand 18 inches from a GP9 and just take it in, you know, and those days are so long gone. It's hard to believe it ever was possible.
Well, you know, that's an interesting thing that you bring up because we used to, the THMB has a big grade, you know, and it ran right kind of by my house and they would have to, Conrail at the time ran a train into Toronto from Buffalo. In the Penn Central days, it was called FT1 and TF2. And in the Conrail days, it was BUCP and CPBU. And they would basically, the Buffalo crew would come into Hamilton and go back on the other half of the train. Right.
Okay.
And the horsepower was rated, it's mostly flat country around here, so the horsepower was rated for that, and sometimes the train would be just over the limit, and they would put pullers on the train to get it up the hill.
It was mostly Jeeps, right?
Yeah, Jeeps and sometimes a switcher, but usually a Jeep 7. And I mean, geez, I can't even remember how many times I rode the pushers or pullers. I mean, you know,
nice.
Because that's the way it was, you know. You got to know the guys, and they knew my dad, and eventually there was, you know, it's like, yeah, you want to ride up to the top of the hill and back? Okay, let's go.
That's,
can't do that anymore, right?
That's awesome. Although I will say I can remember at least one time my son was probably, let's say, 14 or 15. So that's already 20 years ago. But yeah, we were out on the Transcon at Katie's on the BNSF. And we were just standing there, you know, watching this. It was basically a road local out of Barstow, but he had 4-944s on it. And all of a sudden, the guy, you know, he was wearing like this big cowboy hat, and he opens the engineer's window and he starts waving us over. And I thought, oh boy, he's trying to kick us out of here. I was pretty sure we were not on railroad property, but you never know.
Yeah.
And as we get close to the engine, he said, hey, you want to come up in the cab? And we said, yeah. So we went up in the cab, and, you know, we're talking to the guy. It turns out he's just a really, really nice guy. And then at one point, the radio crackled, and he said, okay, hang on a sec. He says, I got to make a move. So he kind of throttled up his 4-9s and started to shove this train. And boy, are you aware of the power of that once that actually starts happening. You know, it's I'd been on other locomotives, but not with that much power at the throttle. You could feel it.
Yeah, I have an interesting cab ride story. I was in Fort Erie once doing some rail fanning, and Fort Erie is about an hour. Well, it's across the river from Buffalo.
Right? Okay.
And so we're out just shooting trains. And so this the crew got called, and they're walking up to the power, and I started chatting with them, and I was like, hey, can I, do you think I could ride back to Hamilton with you? Because that's where I live, and you guys are going through Hamilton. And the hogger says, well, you got to talk to the conductor, he's the boss, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I talked to him, and he's humming and hawing. He's not terribly thrilled with the notion, but then he says, all right, you're up in the cab, but I'm telling you, if anything happens, you have to get out of here.
Right.
I'm like, okay, well, this is crazy, because like 20 minutes into the trip, we almost nailed a car at a grade crossing.
Oh, geez.
And so it's one of those moments where everybody was looking at each other like, whoa, that could have been really bad.
Right.
With this guy in the cab, right? So
would have been one of those life-changing events.
Yeah. Yeah. But we didn't get him. I mean, the car disappeared completely under the nose of the engine. I was shocked that we didn't hit him. But
I got a cab ride one time on Acela. And we almost nailed a deer. I mean, this, I don't know how we missed this thing. I think we grazed its little cottontail. But I said to him, I said, does that happen much? He says, yeah, it happens all the time. He said, usually what happens is we call ahead to the next town, and we have the fire department there, and they just hose off the front of the engine.
Right.
That way we don't have to go into Penn Station, you know, dripping the meat department. So How about that for a powerful image?
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
So have you always been a modeler, or did that come later on in life?
I was always a modeler. Yeah. I think that I probably was more into modeling than trains, you know, like than rail fanning. I had buddies who were, you know, really, really knowledgeable about what was going on, and I just tagged along with them, and, you know, I'd get to see some cool things. But for me, it was really about building models, I think, you know, and even, you know, it's airplanes and boats,
right,
and battleships and all that business.
Same with me. I submarines and, yep, airplanes. Absolutely.
There was a guy
that was before train modeling.
Yeah. There was a guy who used to do like dioramas for one of the big, maybe it was Tamiya or somebody. And I remember I was just fascinated with that guy's work. I wish I could remember his name. I was talking to a friend of mine about him. We want to get someone like that on our virtual RPM that we're going to talk about in a minute. But
he was like the Ken Patterson of military models.
Yeah, I guess something like that. Yeah. So I ended up, you know, kind of kind of applying all of that to trains. And then, you know, high school, by the end, I mean, life changed for me really, really fast after high school. I did a year of college and then I started touring. And so I didn't have a home like to live in. I sometimes went back to my parents' place and I sometimes went, you know, couch surfing with my girlfriend or whatever guys in the band and stuff like that. And a lot of time I was just traveling.
Were you traveling all over just Canada or other places?
Mostly, you know, that business is kind of a feast and famine, right? So I would go out and do like a 6-week stint and then it would be over and I'd have to go find a job like at a factory or something.
I see.
But a lot of it was back then, there was a circuit there were all these different circuits you could play in different parts of the country. So the one that I played the most was like Ontario and Quebec and, mm-hmm.
It's like, all little clubs basically.
It depended on the gig that I got, but then I got into New York State, Pennsylvania, Ohio, a little bit down into Massachusetts. My knowledge of American geography is a little weak. I'm not sure exactly where the state boundaries are, but there was this circuit that went all the way down the coast,
mm-hmm.
and a whole string of these.
Don't feel bad. Most Americans are the same way.
Yeah. The whole string of these clubs that are painted black inside, they all look the same.
And they're
coastal towns, right? And they're all like, I think there's a place called Black Rock. I do have a memory of a place called Black Rock somewhere like Connecticut, maybe. I don't know. Seashore town, right?
Okay.
And up, you know, up into, I didn't play into Boston, but up in that area too. A lot of, one of the bands that I was in was doing basically this Toronto, Montreal, New York City circuit. And it was, because that's how it works sometimes, right? Like they find where their market is, and then they go and they play there. And
sure.
And this one particular band, their whole thing, they couldn't play rural places because there was just no appeal for their music.
Different market.
Yeah. So we would just play, you know, East Village and Greenwich Village and all, you know, down the lower end of Manhattan, mostly over in Queens a little bit. There's a place in Brooklyn we played.
So I'm guessing you weren't doing a lot of modeling during this time.
None. Zero.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, it's a hard life, right? It's a tough go.
And travel, travel, travel.
Yeah. And then, you know, the way that business works, like if things start happening for you, man, they start happening. Like there's all of a sudden you have money.
And you have to ride it.
And well, yeah. And even if it's not my thing, but I'm, you know, I'm paid to be there as a sideman, right? That's what I did a lot of. And so, you know, the thing starts earning money and then you go with it and you go and you go and you go and then it's done. Right. And, there was a lot of that. So, there was zero modeling between like 1988 maybe, or 89 to about 10 years ago. Zero access.
Oh, wow.
Like,
okay.
Not even,
longer than I thought.
Yeah. Like I think there was a brief period where I tried, you know, I tried to get, like, I'd kind of moved into a part-time music thing and I'd landed a solid job for, you know, like 4 or 5 years. And I was living in London with a good friend of mine. And I tried to get back into a little modeling and, it just, if you don't have your own place, you set up tools and all that, it just doesn't happen. Right. And
you have to have it.
Yeah. And then I started teaching. Well, actually, before I started teaching, I went back out and did a bunch of touring again. So, yeah. So
everything I've seen that you've done is within the last 10 years.
Most of it is within the last 7 years. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. And I have to say, maybe it's like with good photographers, you know, you never see their bad pictures, but, it seemed like you either hit the ground running with the skill set or you just, you know, ramped up really fast. I mean, most of us have to make a lot of mistakes to get to an acceptable level.
I think I made a lot of my mistakes, you know, before I kind of left the hobby. And
then
when I came back, things were a lot better. Like, you know, I unpacked a toolbox where all the tools were rusty, like 10 years, 12 years ago, whenever it was that I came back. I opened up that toolbox that I'd moved and moved and moved, and it was all my modeling tools. And I unpacked two boxes of Atheron blue boxes that were you know, stuck in a time capsule from early 1990s, like right. late 1980s, right? And because I was kind of the story, you know, I was kind of in need of a reprieve from the rest of the world, because you know, like even I'm the king of the side hustle, right? So I've got a day job and I do this music thing. Whenever it comes along, I go and do it. So I needed a break, right?
Right.
I needed a way to do something that wasn't a hustle. And so this came along, right? And I think that I probably had developed a lot of the skills before, and I don't really know otherwise. I don't, because I've had people kind of like my neighbor across the road, my good friend. He's a modeler, and he's been a modeler his whole life. Like the story that most people have, right? And long standing friendships with other modelers who've been, you know, they've been modelers since they were kids, and there's been no break, and they've known each other. And he would start bringing people over, and you know, I'd show them my layout or show them my models and show them the stuff that I'm working on. And they would kind of look at me sideways at first. It's like, and I thought, well, maybe my models are crap, right? Like, you just started doing this? I said, well, I didn't really just start it. I had been doing it for a while. So
it's funny you say that, because I had been kind of a lone wolf modeler most of my time modeling. And I got talked into going to a proto meet. I think it might have been, I don't know, might have been Jim Six's proto meet out in Ohio, I think. I'm not entirely sure, but I remember leaving my stuff in the car and being very unsure about bringing it out there. And I went into the meet, and I was with a friend of mine. And he says, aren't you going to bring your stuff? And I said, well, let me just size it up first. You know, I just kind of wanted to see if I was where I thought I was, you know what I mean? I just, you know, you don't want to go in there and embarrass yourself. By the same token, until you've actually kind of seen what's going on, how do you judge it? You know?
Yeah.
So well, I went into the meet, looked around, said, yep, I feel at home here. I went out to the car and brought in my E-line boxes. You know, the rest of it's kind of history in that regard.
I think, you know, like one of the things that's really important is to recognize that we only really know our like what's in our heads, right? So we don't really know like how far along is somebody else and how confident are they? We look at our own work, and if you don't go out to these RPMs and have a look at what other people are doing, you really don't get a chance to go, well, yeah, maybe I'm doing a little better than I thought I was, or maybe, you know, like it's a continuum. There's always going
to
be people.
Yeah. And the only other thing you have to go by are the magazines, and there you're looking at things that are either expertly or professionally photographed, and everything's just, you know, just right. So it's almost an unfair comparison, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like a regular woman comparing herself to the supermodels that she sees in the glossy magazines. You know what I mean? It's there's a lot of post-production, shall we say.
Yeah. And so there's, you know, the other thing about it though, is that like I have, there are gaps in my skills and in my knowledge, because, you know, people who've been in the hobby for all this time would it's like there's a nonstop continuous growth where they know something and then they learn a bunch of new, you know, historical facts, or, and then they're developing skills and they meet other people and they glean new things from them, and they're just constantly growing. Right. But I had this big gap in my involvement with the hobby. And then I come back into it and I sort of pick up where I left off, and then there's a new thing and I'm like, oh, okay, I'll pick that thing up. But then there's other stuff that I had no idea was going on. Right.
Sure. Or,
like, especially with, like I did a little bit of custom painting when I was a kid, actually. And, and paint had changed so much. Like, paint is so fantastic.
Right.
Like, people complain about, well, not complain, but I hear people lamenting or the demise of Floquel. And, I don't know. I don't think my skills are that much better than they were back then, but man, I'm a way better painter now with these paints. We can do a lot of good stuff now.
What are you using for paint now that you really like?
I mean, I have way too much paint, Mike. I have.
Who doesn't?
I know. It's ridiculous.
I have drawers full. My biggest problem is when I want paint, how do I easily find it?
Yeah, it's one of those things. I don't know how it's happened, but I'm running out of space to keep it all.
Right.
But the last thing I painted, I did with Vallejo.
Yes, I've heard good things about that.
I quite like it.
What are you using for a brush?
I've got a three brushes. I've got a VL and I've got a Iwata Eclipse.
Yep.
And a Badger 105.
I've become a complete Iwata convert. I have all these brushes that you mentioned, but yeah. Once I picked up the Iwata, I never reach for the other brushes.
Well, what I, you know, the VL I could probably throw in the garbage at this point or give it away to somebody. Excuse me. I don't use it that much, but the other two, I have them set up permanently and I run them all the time. The 105 is a coverage. I call it a coverage airbrush.
Sure.
And because the way I like to paint, like my color coats is I lay down heavy coats, like so that they're like just before they're running, right? You want, I don't like doing light passes. I like doing good heavy passes that are just heavy enough or just light enough to not run.
Gotcha.
And then the Iwata, I go back in and I do like pre-fading, like detail work with that, right? I'll do pre-fading or I'll load that up for the final dusting for the weathering and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, the Iwata could be a little slow for big areas. I would agree on that.
Yeah, because I've got the big 0.5 tip in the Badger, and I've got, I don't know what it is, a 0.2 or something in the Iwata, so that it's, you know, it's really fine.
Yep, two different animals.
Yeah, and I've, you know, I like helping people out with this because I've heard a lot of people tell me, well, I can't spray acrylics. This doesn't work for me. I think maybe people tend not to look out to the art store enough. You know, like if you go into an art supply store and you tell them you're airbrushing acrylics, there's a lot of products they can offer you to help.
You mean like additives, that kind of thing?
Yeah, like medium. Instead of using anything else to thin your paint down, use acrylic medium.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, you don't want to thin paint down with water or anything else because you're making
water's the problem.
Yeah, that's right.
Too much surface tension.
Yeah, and you're making it weak, right? Like the medium is what holds all the pigments together. And if you thin that out too much, then you end up with paint that just is too fragile. It comes off too easy. And so
you're talking about the same thing like matte medium or gloss medium and like that kind of thing?
It's called acrylic paint medium.
Okay.
Yeah. And then, you know, flow improvers, you got to use those. You use those two things. Those two things alone. You start with those two things, you won't get dry tip anymore on your airbrush with acrylic.
Interesting. Interesting. I mean, I'm kind of a, you know, scale coat two sort of a guy. And
yeah.
I found that once I started using scale coat two, all my painting issues just kind of went away.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have much of an incentive to deviate from that because it just works for me. And, you know, not for weathering, obviously, but I mean, no. if you're painting something, that's kind of what I always default to.
It's great coverage paint.
Right.
My issue with it is that I like working fast. When I get a chance to sit down with a model, I don't want to have to wait 3 days for it to dry. So
Right.
And
you must have liked AccuPaint then.
No, I didn't really like that paint too much, no.
It dried fast though, didn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, a little too fast, I think.
The acetone base probably?
Yeah, I think so. I forget.
Have you messed around with True Color?
Yeah. I like that paint. That's good paint. Yeah.
I've only brushed it so far. I haven't sprayed it yet. I've got some to do.
I like, you know, it's a shame. I liked the Polyscale.
Yes.
And
it was very useful.
And the Model Master, the Tester's Model Master paint.
Right.
Both the acrylics and the enamels, actually.
They like just they had no interest in that business anymore.
It's a shame, you know, like it was good paint.
I mean, it must be that there are fewer and fewer people painting things all the time. I guess if you compare the size of a manufacturer's on-deck run versus decorated, I'm sure the on-decks are dwarfed.
Well, yeah, I think there are fewer people building things, right? I think that's what's happening. Is that,
exactly.
You know, there's not as many. I think that might change because I think we're in a bit of a blip with the sort of long arc of I guess it's labor costs, global
right.
labor costs, right? I think we're in a bit of a blip and that might change. And I don't know how much longer. I mean, what do I know? You're listening to me talking like I know something. But
hey,
I don't know.
You know, your opinion is just as good as I think almost anybody's.
I wonder.
We're all making it up as we go along.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's how I model. to be honest, Mike, is I just make it all up as I go along.
Yeah,
so
well,
I don't know how.
I've made
how
an entire career out of that, Jerry. Yeah, so, you know.
You know what? I can walk up on stage and stand up in front of 12,000 people and make it up as I go along. So,
so you're doing something right there. You must be good at this making up things business. But, you know, just an anecdote on Undex.
Yeah.
Just the other day, I unboxed a proto SW1200 Undec. And I had ordered it because it had flexi-coil trucks, and I wanted to do an X New Haven unit. It'll be my only, in Conrail days, of course, it'll be my only flexi-coil trucked in cab switcher. And I opened up the box, and I started looking at the parts bags, and you could almost detail another locomotive with what's in the parts bags. They had everything.
Yeah.
They had AAR trucks. They had two kinds of handrails. You want a Hancock air whistle? It's in there. You know, like whatever you could think of that could possibly be associated with an SW1200, it was in there. And that's all Bob Tusink at Walther's. He's the guy responsible for making sure that what's in the bags is in the bags. And he did a great job.
The hobby is, it's an amazing hobby now. Like it has never been this good. You know, this is like you can choose, right? You could buy a tangent car as a kit.
Yeah, the tangent came to mind as soon as you said that. I said, yeah. I smile every time I take a tangent car out of the box, clip off the Katie Gladhand and weather it. And that's right. It.
Yep.
You know, that's it.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever added anything to a tangent freight car.
There are so many ways to be in this hobby too, right? Like there are people who, I mean, I started selling a little bit of my work because there's some things that I wanted to buy that wanted to build that I couldn't really use on my layout. And so I decided that what I might do with projects like that is I'll build them. And there's always somebody that wants to buy something without having to try too hard. Someone will buy it from me.
It's true. So what's an example of that?
I bought some CN gondolas and I had way too many of them. I had like those Rapido Canadian gondolas. Yeah, I had, I don't know how many, probably far too many. And I decided to keep, I think, four. And I posted some pictures on Facebook and on my blog, I think. And then and then somebody got in touch with me and said, hey, are you interested in doing some commission work? And I said, well, not really. I don't want to do commission work necessarily. He's like, I really like those gondolas. I'm like, well, I happen to have extras if you want, and I'll do them up the way that the ones in the photos are done. And so he was happy to take them off my hands.
My buddy Mike Confalone has been making a little side career out of doing just that. You know, I think he looked at his fleet and like all of us probably had five times what he actually needed to run his railroad. And he thought, what am I going to do with all of this stuff?
Yeah.
And, you know, he just started weathering some of them and putting them on eBay and developed a little clientele. And now basically anything he puts up there sells. And some of us have been horrified at the stuff that he sold, but he tells us, no, relax. This is just, you know, I've still got the ones that you liked. These are extras.
Sure.
So he's doing,
well, I mean,
he,
if you did it once,
well,
you can do it again, right? Yeah.
Absolutely.
So tell me about how you met him. Because you told me at the beginning of this conversation that you used to be a lone wolf modeler. So I'm interested in the trajectory of that friendship.
Yeah, no, well, I guess there's basically two ways that I've met the increasingly large number of friends I have in the model railroading field. I mean, the first way was to go to a proto meet or two.
Yeah.
And then I went through a period of time there where I went to basically all of them pretty much. It had gotten ridiculous, but again, that's why I know people all over the country now. You know, I've been to WPM and I've been to, you name it, you know, Cocoa Beach zillions of times and Savannah and, you know, Naperville and you name it. So that was one way, but also, and this, I think, predates that period just a little bit. There was a rise of online model railroad activity with Yahoo groups, and even before that, some some Usenet groups. I don't know if you remember those.
No, I think so. You're going back like 15 years, probably.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah. At least.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, that it was crude, but that's kind of how it all started. And on one of these discussion groups, some guy named Mike Confalone posted a question about, you know, what people must have been in the early days of him doing his own weathering, because he's expert now, but he wanted to know how to what's the best way to model kaolin spills.
Oh, cool.
And as luck would have it, I had just come back from the Savannah meet, and we always did a little rail fanning down there. Bob Harp used to take a few of us around, you know, guys like Warren Calloway and whoever I brought with me, and we'd go, you know, hit up all the local rail fan spots down there. And there was a big kaolin spill in the yard there. So we took some Ziploc bags and filled it up. And although it looked like a scene out of Miami Vice, I was glad I was driving back. Let's put it that way. You know, I came back with a Ziploc bag full of real kaolin. And I had had some success using it as a medium for modeling kaolin spills. I mean, basically a little kaolin and some alcohol down the side of the car, and it looks just like the actual kaolin spill. So I told him that, and I said, you know, if you need some, I'll send you some. And I think he was impressed with that. Next thing you know, he's inviting me up to his place, and, you know, I go to look at his gigantic, barely under construction layout at that time. And it's, you know, it was big, and it was probably one of the largest unfinished layouts I'd ever seen. And I remember thinking, this guy's out of his mind. He's going to need 10 lifetimes to finish this thing.
Yeah.
But little did I know that he was going to, out of necessity, develop some innovative fast-tracking techniques that I would later fully embrace for my own layout kabooms. And, you know, and we'd be fast friends. So you just never know how it's going to go.
Yeah.
And that was all just, I answered some guy's question on a bulletin board. You know what I mean? So it's funny how the connections that you make, but you click it with is, who you click with. You know what I mean? It's just kind of how it works.
I think that, you know, what I've been finding too is that there are, it's a bit harder when you sort of haven't been in the hobby, you know, took a good 20 years off, right? And then, you know, sort of finding your way back in was a little bit of a challenge because you don't know as many people, right? So I spent a little bit of time just trying to sort that out too, right? Trying to find people around here and find, like I wanted to join a club, because when I first got back into the hobby, I didn't live in the house that I'm in now, and I didn't have a space for a layout. Right. And so I thought, well, I could build models on the kitchen table kind of thing and join a club. And so I mean, 1 month back into the hobby after 20 years, and I joined the Waterloo Club, which is kind of, they aspire to be the La Mesa Club of Canada, right?
Okay.
Like that's, they're after that.
It's a high bar.
Yeah. Well, it is. Yeah. And that's, so that was good for me to be around people. Unfortunately that club is a good hour and 15 minute drive. So it got to be the point where I really couldn't follow the rest of my life too, right? Playing gigs and all that business and disappearing for a little while and coming back. I really couldn't maintain, I couldn't really participate in long-term, you know, contributions to projects and that sort of thing. So I backed away. But I'm, you know, still close with all those guys, and they're great modelers, and they're, I always said that it was like being in that particular club. It was like being a member of a club where everybody has a PhD in railroad history, because these guys were so knowledgeable. It just blew my mind. Like,
there is so much knowledge out there. Oh, it is amazing. Yeah. Your story reminded me of, in the very, very early days, after I built my house, which is now like 31 years ago. And I was just starting my own model railroad here. With the techniques I was employing, which were, you know, really embarrassingly dated techniques, it was taking me forever. Meanwhile, I was building and kit bashing and painting and weathering a lot of freight cars and locomotives and what have you, which is really where all the energy was going.
Yeah.
And there was a club above Boston called the North Shore Club, which was a decent sized club, was known for having tremendous track work. And somebody I knew was a member up there. And he said, you know, you should bring up some of your stuff and run trains. And I said, well, how much stuff should I bring? He says, bring anything you can bring because the layout's huge. And I think they had like a 50-inch radius, minimum radius for the curves. And, you know, just really built to a high standard. So I thought, all right, I've got all of these auto racks and 86-foot boxcars. I'll bring up that and I'll bring up, a grain train. So I ended up running an 84-car grain train up there with like six units on it and had a ball. And when I got to the other side of the layout, I realized I had drawn kind of a crowd because one of the members said, nobody brings stuff like this in here. Nobody runs a train like this. And I thought, no kidding. Well, I'm happy to do it, except that it's, like you said, an hour and a half away for me. And how often can you really, you know, commit to doing that? So I did it a handful of times, but, you know, it was better for the experience, I think.
Yeah. That sounds amazing.
Taught me the necessity of great track work and what it's like to run a big train on a big layout. You know, not that layout is that big, but.
Yeah. I think the other thing that I learned from being in a club with high aspirations and you know, it's a big layout they have. It's a 7-level mushroom thing.
Right? 7 levels.
It's over 2 stories, right? Like they have
like La Mesa.
They have helices that go up through to the second floor. They have.
Have you run at La Mesa? Have you been to it?
No, I tried, but
they do it almost to complete scale.
Yeah.
So when you're going up into the mountains and going around to Hatchabee, you start out on the first floor and you end up on the second floor.
Wow.
So it's like you described, and I get to run there once. It was just great.
Yeah, I'll have to. I don't know a whole lot of people. I know. Who do I know out west? Not a lot of model train people out there. So, and they're
if you end up going out there, let me know and I can plug you into a couple of guys who will, you know, give you the cook's tour.
Well, when this COVID thing is over, I've got to get caught up with a lot of people I have a lot of American friends, a lot of people that I stayed in touch with from the days that I was playing down there all the time. And then, it seems to me like I have more American model train friends than Canadian friends. Just maybe it's because I model an American prototype. I don't know, but lots of American friends that I haven't seen now for 7 months. Well, he's more than 7 months.
Tell me about it.
And it's getting to the point where it's like, you know, I really miss my friends and
right.
Miss seeing everybody.
We're all officially thoroughly sick of the whole thing, but the whole thing doesn't seem to care.
No, we had an outbreak at work. So, you know, it's like, it's not going away just yet. So
let's get back to your layout. You know, you got into your house and I don't know if you had been planning this in advance, but you know, any kind of layout venture involves obviously X amount of pre-planning. So I'm interested to hear how you arrived at what you decided to model and, you know, tell us a little bit about what you are modeling.
So I was a member of the Waterloo Club and they modeled the CP and, you know, which in Sudbury, Ontario, and it's a really cool prototype to model. It is not really my interest though. Nonetheless, you know, I contributed models to that club. And at the same time, I thought, well, if I had a home layout, I really don't need to scratch the giant layout itch because I've got that at the club, right? And I thought, if I had a home layout, what would it be? And
what's interesting to you?
Yeah. And so, and you know, some of the things that were the most interesting to me were the THMB, but it's not, THMB is not a very modelable railroad.
Why is that?
Sorry about that. I'm singing all day. my throat's just destroyed today. Because because the urban part of the THMB services giant industries that are too big to effectively model in a house. Like you need a barn,
okay,
you know, to model a steel mill, you know, in a way that captures its scale. And
the only one I've seen in person is Ken McCrory's, you know, and he has a whole building just for that purpose.
Yeah. You know what? So I'm going to have to say, I don't know who that is. Cause like we've already established, I'm a bit of a tourist. in the hobby. And so there's a giant gap in my, I don't know.
No, that's okay. He's been in the magazines, but he's got,
I'm sure he's a great modeler if you're,
he lives just west of Philly, and he's got a purpose built building for this. And, it's a very impressive layout from a scale standpoint. And,
I thought you were about to say he lives, you know, in Toronto or something. And I'd be like, oh, someone who lives down the road and I don't even know who he is. Which wouldn't surprise me because it
could happen.
No, so THMB is, in my opinion, you know, my humble opinion, it's difficult to model it well in the way that I would like to model, I guess, which doesn't, you know, doesn't suggest that someone couldn't do it. It's just, I don't feel like I could do it.
Sure.
And then the cross country parts of the THMB, once you get out of the city, are kind of just flat and straight.
Yeah.
And it's a high speed, you know, pipeline sort of thing. And the Lehigh Valley was my other sort of railroad that I quite loved.
Yeah, good choice.
And it turns out there's a place in the world where both of those railroads run across the same track. And that's why I picked the place that I model.
Which is?
North Tonawanda, which is the Niagara Branch. It's on the Niagara Branch of the New York Central, which connects Buffalo to their border crossing at Niagara Falls, New York, in Niagara Falls, Ontario.
Yeah.
So the Lehigh Valley's last couple of miles, well, at the west end of the Lehigh Valley, it splits at Niagara Junction, and the southern, it's like a Y, right? Y-shaped arrangement. And the southern leg of the Y goes down to TIFF Street Terminal, or TIFF Terminal. And the northern part goes up to Niagara Falls, their suspension bridge yard at Niagara Falls. And so to get all the way into Niagara Falls, the last couple of miles, they go across the Niagara branch of the former New York Central. And the THMB trains that I mentioned earlier in the Penn Central era were called FT1 and TF2. Those trains every second day, because they alternated power, every second day they would have THMB power. And on alternating days, they would have the St. Thomas Canada Southern power. And so I had the ability to model a town where, you know, the Lehigh Valley ran, I think it was NE1 and COJ2. COJ30, I think is the name of the train. I can't remember. And NE1 is the other one.
Yeah.
Those are sort of daily. Well, I mean, in the end, I don't think anything was daily anymore, but you know, if we're modeling a day, I'm picking a day when those trains ran. So,
sure.
Because I think the way that it worked is the train would come out of Sayre, it would head out to Niagara Falls as NE1, I think, and then it would just drop its train and couple on to the eastbound train, which was COJ 30 or something.
Someone's That's very interesting because my northern terminus in staging is Sayre, so we could basically almost interchange.
Yeah, well, that's cool. So that's kind of like, that's the short version of how I decided, you know, where it was going to be.
And the era would be, is it a particular date, or do you not worry so much about that?
Well, I picked up this from the Waterloo Club, where they decided that, you know, anything in the 70s would fly.
Yep.
So their era is anything 1970.
So it's a 10-year spread.
Yeah. So I decided that I would start off kind of thinking about it as the Penn Central era.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, the more that I learn, the more I think that it's probably something like 73 is probably the sweet spot. Because there's a moment there where, or there's like a few months there where they had the Jeep 38s and a couple F units still running together at the same time. I don't think the U-23s were on the property yet. I think those were kind of Conrail engines painted in Lehigh Valley colors because they didn't have a paint scheme yet or something like that. So I think that, you know, you can have like brand new Jeep 38s and the last F unit, or maybe the last two F units.
I couldn't tell you when PC got U-23s, but that was a late phase model for GE right before the, you know, the Dash 7. So that might've been, you know, later on, maybe a U-25 or something like that.
Like the Lehigh Valley Jeep 38s, I think they started showing up late 72 or something, and in two batches maybe.
Okay.
I know I have this information somewhere, but it's not, you know, there's a lot of stuff rattling around in my head. That's not something that stays in the, you know.
So on your layout, is it a switching layout or is it run staging to staging? Like, give me a sense of the concept.
So the concept was that I was concerned that my life was too busy to build a layout. And so I designed something. Yeah, I'm not kidding. So I designed something that I thought, you know, I'm going to build one of the industries from North Tonawanda. And if I can finish that and get it completely done, then I'm confident that I can build the rest of it.
So what industry did you choose?
So I picked International Paper, which is on Tonawanda Island, which is in the Niagara River, like separated by...
That's what your clinic was on. This is starting to ring a bell.
Yeah.
See, it's all in there. It's just that the references are a little rusty.
Mike, I know the feeling.
Yeah.
So that's what I've built, is I've built this 12-foot long paper plant. It's about, 14 inches wide, maybe 16 inches in one spot. It kind of widens out a little bit. And I just switch the paper plant. As it takes about 90 minutes. It's, you know, you can go at a pretty slow pace.
Yeah.
And so I've been kind of
when you say you switch it, are you coming in with a local? Is there a plant switcher? Give them a little more detail here.
Yeah, it's like a local.
The memory banks.
Yeah, North Tonawanda had two jobs that worked, you know, locally out of the yard. And one of them went to the island and the other one kind of messed around town and went up the Lockport branch, I think, part ways. And so I'm modeling the one local job that goes onto the island and switches the plant for most of the day. I think, you know, talking to some railroaders who were around at the time, I think there was a little bit of like, you know, stretching the job out to last the whole day kind of thing.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So, but I mean, you know, the plant was running two shifts, sometimes three. And I have some technical data, you know, they would put out like 7 carloads of paper a day. So, I mean, the physical grounds of the plant aren't huge. And so that stuff has to be you know, they have to move that out to get out of the way.
And was it chemicals and pulp in also?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, not pulp. They made their own pulp, but it was chips and chemicals, obviously. In the late 60s, it was still logs. They would bring in the logs on lake boats from Northern Ontario.
Jeez.
Yeah.
This is probably why it's on an island, right?
Well, if you can imagine lake boats coming down the Niagara River and unloading a few miles up from the falls.
Jeez.
And then they switched the plant over to run off of chips instead of logs. And then they would run, they'd bring the chips in from Canada mostly. So chips and all the chemicals and all the various things.
But the chips came in by rail too, right? Or was that truck?
Yeah. In fact, that's the last piece of the puzzle I'm working on right now. I've got some wood chip cars, some CN wood chip cars that are built from 1920s single sheath box cars. So they peel the roofs off and then they make them into gondolas. Yeah, and they were still running these things just into the. I think the early to mid 70s.
So it sounds kind of like the kind of thing that was going on in the whole Maine paper industry too at that time.
Yeah. I think, you know, like, I don't know if you know about the Love Canal thing.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Great so chemical, that, right?
Right. Yeah. So, Occidental, which was Hooker, Hooker's new name, I guess they had a big sort of disaster from what I can gather, I've unearthed some historical documents that indicate that the state of New York and the province of Ontario did some studies about the water quality in the Niagara River, and then a whole bunch of industrial abatement programs ensued after that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what happened, I'm kind of connecting the dots on this. I think that International Paper might have been convinced to shut the plant down. You know, and there, because it was a pretty primitive plant. It was small. It was small, and it was not very modern. I know this because I've since met a person who worked at the plant, and it was a very specialized plant because they made high gloss papers, and they made paper for the mint, the U.S. Mint.
Oh, wow.
So it's very special runs of paper that I think my impression is the more specialized the paper is, the more nasty things come out of the plant when you make it.
Well, you figure that the paper that currency is printed on has a metallic thread content to it, doesn't it?
I don't know. I think there's cotton in it too, but I'm not really sure.
Yeah. So they got kaolin. They got a lot of other chemicals in tank cars.
Yeah, yeah. All that business.
What's there now?
A park.
A park. Wow. Yeah, it's so some serious mitigation there.
Yeah, there's been nothing has been there since, right? I think there's a marina next to the park. But yeah, I've strolled around in the park, and the foundations of the plant are still there. So I got a sense of the buildings are so small. Like it looks big. I've got some aerial photos that were taken in the early 70s or late 60s or something. And it looks, you know, when you sort of measure, okay, well, that's 10 boxcars long, or that building's right, one boxcar long, and this and that. And then you get down on the ground and you look at the same building's foundations, and you realize, you know, this really was not a very big plant. Like, they really had a lot of, sort of densely packed in, right?
So, well, you know, a 40-foot boxcar doesn't take up a whole lot of real estate. It really doesn't.
No. And so that's kind of how I asked it, because they had a small two-track yard that you know, was out at the end of the plant. And the tracks were 10 cars long. So
right. It's
not very much track, right? I mean, it's perfectly sized for a layout, for a 12-foot long HO layout. And I had to compress it.
So, well, that was my next question. So did the relative small size of the prototype enable you to build it almost to scale, or is it half the size? Like, how much compressing did you have to do?
It's pretty close. Yeah.
Okay.
I've been able to fairly closely replicate what the buildings look like. And then there's BS factor in there too.
Oh yeah.
Some of the buildings you can't really see, right? So I was sort of guessing, like one of the buildings, this is an interesting story.
You never get it all. You can't.
Oh, no. And if you know, if you wait to get it all, you'll never build it. So one of the buildings was the powerhouse. So they burned coal, obviously, right, to make their own electricity. And
that came in by rail too, of course.
Yeah, which it did. Yeah. And so I made some assumptions about what the powerhouse was built out of. I could see the overall shape of it from the aerial photos, right? So I had a sense of what the shape is, what the coal silo looked like. And
was it brick?
No. Well, this is the best part of the story. So I looked at it and I went, well, that must be a concrete, you know, building, an early poured concrete building. And so I built it up and weathered it and put it on the layout. And then a person who worked at the plant saw my blog. He said, I'm not really interested in trains or model trains, but that wasn't a concrete building. I'm like, what?
What was it?
It was like an iron frame building that was clad in sheet metal.
Oh, wow.
And he said to me, you know, when you think about it, it's a boiler, right? So if it explodes, which it shouldn't, but if it explodes, or if they need to pull the boiler out and replace it,
you want really, flimsy walls.
Yeah, you can't do that with a poured concrete building unless it's got giant openings, which I have seen some powerhouses that are like that. They're brick or whatever, but the window openings are huge, right? So they can slide a whole boiler in through the window. But I didn't even think of that, right? So
did you take your building and just apply corrugated siding to it?
No, I took it. It's in a drawer in my desk right now. Maybe somebody will buy that from me, but follow my Confalon's lead. And I rebuilt it. And, you know, whatever. It's a hobby, right? You learn something and you go, oh, I had completely got that wrong. And then
it could be useful to somebody.
Yeah, maybe. Another one of my buildings is it's a Walters, kind of a kit bash from a Walters building. Because the building that is in that spot, like the whole layout is scratch built structures and they're big, right? And I just wanted to operate the layout. So I thought, I'm just going to, you know, there's this Walters thing that fits in the space. It's going to live there until I have the desire to replace it.
Yep. My layout, I would say 95% scratch built structures because it's a prototype based layout. And I want it to look like the prototype and not necessarily what's available to me, but there's a smattering of some Walters buildings there. I've used a lot of them as raw materials, I will say.
Yeah.
But I know what you mean about the compression thing. You know, people walk in sometimes and they look at the Mahoopany complex and it's like, you know, 8 or 9 feet long and it's on a blob as a peninsula. And one of the reasons I chose that spot and that prototype was because the prototype is on a peninsula blob in the river. So literally its footprint is very, very, very reminiscent, if you look at the aerials, of the actual facility. Hmm. The only thing is, even though it's probably 6 feet of building, it's probably a tenth of the size of the actual prototype.
So tell me about, like, this is kind of embarrassing, but you have to tell me a little bit about, like, what part of the world is your layout?
Oh, sure.
You said the staging is in Sayre, right?
Yeah, I model a portion of the Conrail-Lehigh line in 1984. Right.
Okay.
And my south staging is Allentown.
Oh.
But the first visible portion of the layout is, so let me just say what the footprint of the whole thing is, because it's modeling a spaghetti bowl. The prototype is a spaghetti bowl.
It's true.
So it took me a long time to kind of get my arms around it. But if you start from south staging at Allentown, you will end up eventually at north staging at Sayre. However, now that I've built my addition and added onto the layout, south staging Allentown can also be an origination point for D&H trains, which traveled also over the Lehigh line and then got back onto their own rails at DuPont.
Yeah, they were the trains coming down from Buffalo at that time.
Right.
Think, right?
Well,
no,
I mean,
those are Southern Tier trains, I think.
That's right. So, I mean, yeah. You know, basically what happened north of that point, I'm not terribly interested in, because After a D&H train goes through DuPont, it pretty quickly goes behind some trees and then ends up going, you know, going off layout. And going north through DuPont, you're coming into Taylor. I don't know if you're familiar with where Taylor is, you know, near Scranton. Yeah. So the focal point of the middle of the layout is sort of Pittston Yard, you know, and Pittston Junction, where all of this stuff came together, the Lehigh Valley Mountain cutoff and all of that. So, depending
really
upon
cool.
which direction you're coming from, northbound train, you're going to hit, southbound train, you're going to hit Mahoopany really. And it's 3 yards, as the first thing you really encounter when you're coming out of staging, and then you'll eventually continue on to Pittston and onward from there. So it's enough layout for me to, you know, handle me the rest of my born days here.
So by 1984, had Conrail changed the track configuration on the Lehigh line all that much, or was it mostly?
There were other events driving things, right? So one of the main driving point for 84, there's two reasons. You talked about a sweet spot earlier. Yeah, you picked that 73 date. The 84 date for me does a couple of things. It gets me all the motive power that I want. I can have something as modern as an SD50, but I can still have an SD35, and I can have a nice mix of eras of power. But the other main consideration is the Mahoopany plant was still shipping out by rail. And it wasn't until the late 80s that Conrail ticked them off sufficiently that they said, that's it, we're shipping out by truck. And today, this is the largest Procter & Gamble plant in the world. If you went to that facility, you'd probably see 400 trailers parked there. You know, I read one time that if Procter & Gamble shut down all of their plants, the output of Mahoopany would still be larger than all of them combined.
Wow.
So it's that, you know, it's that big. And they're a major customer for Reading and Northern now. But in the Lehigh Valley days, in your era, this was their number two customer behind Bethlehem Steel.
Hmm. Okay.
And they would generate 100 car loadings outbound a day there.
Right.
That's wow. a lot of, that's a lot of TP and paper towels.
Wow. So that's pretty cool.
So it's a great, you know, it's a great revenue generator, and it's really a fun place to switch because it has a lot of prototypical track arrangement. Just the whole thing is, you know, compressed, which is why a lot of the track had to be custom built.
Yeah. So why the Conrail era and not like the Lehigh Valley era?
Well, that's a valid question. I think because
if I had built it, it would be, you know, I would have built it in 1974.
No, I get it. I think when I started, I mean, you know how you started talking about you were late to the railfan party and you were basically a modeler and weren't really sure. So same with me. I wasn't railfanning until, you know, much later in my life. It was basically, you know, built the house, got the business on its feet. Things started to settle down a little bit. And I probably got out and started railfanning in earnest in the very late 80s, early 90s. And I'm a prototype modeler. I model what I see. So for the longest period of time, I was a 90s era Conrail modeler. And in fact, I was basically staying current with Conrail. So if they got some new power, I got some new power. You know, I wasn't, my era was sort of moving along with it. And honestly, I was very unfocused like that and had basically just a pretty, you know, freelanced railroad until the end of Conrail. And I remember thinking about it and thinking, wow, I'm now a period modeler if I stay with Conrail. And then when I started thinking about it that way, I started thinking, you know, maybe I should pick a period. And I just started to think about it a lot and talk to people a lot and, you know, operated a lot of other people's layouts and saw things I liked there that I wasn't doing. And, you know, I just put a lot of thought into it. And really, I didn't pick the prototype that I was intent on until I kind of stumbled upon this portion of the Lehigh line. I was familiar with it in the, you know, the sort of eastern portion of it, but this whole Snake's Path portion of it going up the river, I knew nothing about. I just kind of stumbled upon it when I was bouncing around in Pennsylvania one time, and I really liked what I saw. To me, it looked like a layout as I was driving around there. Steep wooded hillsides and the tracks and the roads and everything kind of crammed into these narrow valleys along the river, and it's really beautiful.
It really is. I've been in that part of the world. I love
it. Yeah. So, but I didn't want to let go of Conrail.
Right.
So, because I had fallen for it, you know what I mean? I had spent a lot of fun years modeling Conrail and, you know, I was kind of hooked on it. So, as I got more and more information, I realized that if I wanted to model that area, I needed to backdate. And then that caused me to really seriously look at what information I needed to do that right. And, you know, met several people who worked there on those railroads in that era who were just storehouses of invaluable information. You know, I've said more than once on the podcast and to anybody who'll listen that I can probably count on two hands with a couple fingers left over the key people information-wise that make my layout what it is, and lacking that input, I don't know what it would look like. It would just be, I would have had to wing so much of it. But I had a guy come visit one time who lives in that area, and he's walking around the layout, and he was with his son, and he said, oh, look at that. I used to fish right there. And, oh, yeah, I remember that place. He was reminiscing, walking around, looking at my layout, and I took that as a positive thing.
Yeah, that's, you know you're doing it right when you've, as a prototype modeler, when people recognize the scenes on your layout, you know, I think that's the best you could hope for, right?
Right, and it's only gotten more so from there. So when I built DuPont, yeah. I didn't know I was going to model DuPont, but a Reading and Northern engineer friend of mine took us down there, and as soon as I walked up to it, I said, okay, I have to build this. I mean, I just have to do this. Yeah. It's I don't know if you know DuPont, but it's where a road bridge crosses the D&H, which is crossing the Conrail lines, which is crossing a stream, all stacked above one another.
I haven't been there.
It's one of the coolest things.
So do you have
still cool?
It sounds cool. Well, I think I've seen a photo of that on Facebook or something. Because you've got that scene.
No doubt.
I'm pretty sure I've seen that. So do you have because this sounds like a large layout. Do you have a crew of people that come in and, you know, help you build?
Well, most of the building, my buddy Dave had just retired and helped me immensely with a lot of the bench work. Because you know how bench work is. Yeah. It's much easier with two guys. And, you know, all of my friends have worked on my layout at one time or other. Usually when I find like that I suck at something that they don't, and then they come and show me how to do it right.
Right.
And vice versa, you know, we all work on each other's layouts, or at least, you know, we always did. And, but I would say that I probably built 98% of it.
Wow. Yeah. The whole thought of building a layout that big would just, I mean, eventually I'm going to retire, so I think I could do it then, but right now.
Well, you talk about yours is 7 years old. I mean, I'm self-employed, so I get to sort of make my own schedule, but yeah. It's not like I don't work. And, but you know what, when you make your own schedule, you can really kind of budget your time a lot more efficiently than if you're beholden to somebody else's time schedule. So yeah. I think from that standpoint, I don't waste a lot of time, and I'm motivated and really enjoy everything I do on the layout. So, you know, I get a lot done. But if you know, people have said to me, how long have you been building your layout? How long did it take to build? And I always think, what are we talking about here? Because I've rebuilt it a couple of times. I look at the last 7 years, and there's that magical time period that you mentioned. Really, the bulk of what you see when you come in and look at my layout is 7 years, maybe a half, worth of work. So it's very achievable.
Right. Well, you know, yeah, I should have more layout built than I do for having worked on it for 7 years. I think I manage maybe an hour of hobby time, maybe every second night. And that's my pace, right? That's about all I have.
It's not bad. Although when you're actually that's great for modeling, for working on the layout. You need so you need some afternoons, you know?
Yeah, you need some.
Like a good 4 hour chunk of time is when you can really get into the groove.
Yeah. And extra hands would help too. You know, having some people around to I think that would make me feel more confident about accomplishing something bigger. If I had some people to help me with bench work. Cause you know, there are things that we just loathe, right? In the hobby. Well, maybe not everyone. I see
a lot of people say that, you know, for me personally, the really attractive thing about the hobby, because I have a lot of like a wide range of interests.
Yeah.
And this hobby enables me to scratch all the itches. I enjoy carpentry. I loved building all the bench work. I liked doing the wiring. I'm trying to think of it. I mean, I've kind of made a friend of making trees, so I don't even mind that anymore.
Yeah.
Which, you know, when you've made as many as I have, you better make a friend of that. You know, if you're modeling my area, you need trees. You know, you just need to get your mind right about it. So for me, I can't really think of a single thing in the hobby that I go, oh, I wish I didn't have to do that. I just don't have that.
Some of my bench work looks like it was made with an axe and a hatchet. And then a friend of mine, I made friends with this guy that's a modeler as well. And he has like all this woodworking stuff. So I went to his house and he's got this joiner thing and, you know, drill press, table saws. And he's like, well, just go buy yourself, you know, a couple of sheets of plywood and
bring them over here,
bring it in your pickup truck and come over. And we built bench work in an afternoon that looks like it's part of an aircraft fuselage or something. Right. Like
right.
It's beautiful.
Right. I mean, I have a full woodworking shop with all the tools you could imagine.
Wow.
And yet when I went to Confalones, he built his whole thing with a chop saw and a jigsaw that's from like 1940. I remember saying to him one time, because I was working on something at his house, I said, I need a file. And he looked at me and says, I don't have a file. And I looked at him like, who doesn't have a file? He did.
You know, I don't I don't feel so bad now when you tell me that story. You're actually making me feel like there might be a place for me in this
hobby
after all.
There's a spectrum,
right?
You know? I mean, really. Mm-hmm. And I've seen what you have modeled. So I wanted to get, before we get too far along, I wanted to just make sure that I understood, you know, you built your paper mill.
Yeah.
And I saw the clinic on that, which was great. How much more layout is there besides that?
There's some construction, and then that's about it.
So we have to motivate you, young man.
Yeah, there's about a third of the rest of the layout is bench work, and then beyond that, there's a big open room that I have yet to kind of nail down exactly which pieces, signature pieces, I want to incorporate. That's where we're at. I do a lot of building right now at my workbench. I've set myself up with a really nice workbench. And
what are you building?
Right now I'm building 4 CN wood chip cars, and I've got a Canon and Company, one of those laser cut styrene cars.
Oh, those things are great, aren't they?
Beautiful. Beautiful. It's like scratch building, but all the parts are pre-cut.
Exactly. Exactly.
A lot of resin stuff. I'm doing some of this stuff is like, are things that I want to build because I want to write articles on them as well. So some, ACNF Redding cars that, the resin kits are steam era, but I'm going to build them like they appeared in 1972 or 73. So I think that would make for a neat article, to describe what do you do to this resin kit to get this very unique box car that you can't get otherwise,
right?
To make it up, you know, bring it up to date to 1973. So that's another thing that's over there on the bench. Let me look. A couple covered hoppers that a person wants me to weather for them, and
yep. But it's basically freight cars and things like that. You're not really working on any structures or anything right now.
No structures right now. I just had an article in Craftsman about a structure that I built, which was the annex to the recovery boiler for the paper plant. Just a real simple project, and I thought it would make for a nice article because it's really, really straightforward. It's just a box, right, with windows. And
which issue was it in?
Maybe August.
Okay.
Or September, maybe.
I'm going to have to try to dig that up.
Yeah.
Is Craftsman your only outlet that you write for?
Right now, yeah. Yeah. The two main magazines have their own niche, right? And I don't know if anything that I write would really fit over at MR.
No, I would agree.
It doesn't, you know, I still think it's a good magazine. It's just that I don't think that, you know, scratch building structures is really their wheelhouse anymore.
No, it's not. And they also kind of tend to rewrite things in their own sort of style. So there's a sort of a homogenous feel to the prose, I think. And, you know, you're an author, so I don't think you'd like that.
Otto doesn't really, and Stephen before him, they don't really do a whole lot. I think Stephen did a bit more, I would say.
Really?
I think Stephen did a little massaging. A little coaching. Otto just kind of.
I skipped right over Stephen. You know, I mean, I wrote for years for Bill Schomburg, who was great to work for, and
he's a great guy, eh? I hung out with him.
Everybody loves Bill. Yeah,
he's at the bar at Chicago, and he was fantastic. Yeah,
he was holding court.
He was. Well, yeah, we had a lot of fun.
Yeah, he's just a great guy.
Yeah.
I've had more dinners with him probably than any other magazine editor.
Yeah. Sorry about my dog barking in the background there. If you can.
That's okay. Anybody who missed Scott Mason's dog barking on every podcast, you know, will find that very, you know, very reminiscent of the of that.
She's actually a whole floor away, but she's got a big mouth.
Yeah. Wow. So you have several blogs, right? At least two that I'm aware of.
I have two. Yeah. What one is kind of
why
dormant.
The two?
Well, I started blogging when I. Just after I got back into the hobby, because I mean, day one, when I decided, you know, I was going to look at model railroading again, I did a Google search and came up with some blogs that I was like, wow, look at what's going on in this hobby. And it's like, hey, I write, I could do some blogging,
right?
This would be fun. I could write and I could build model trains. And then I joined that Waterloo Club shortly after. I think that was day 30. I joined the Waterloo Club, and then started blogging about the things that I was doing. All of the modeling I was doing was informed by my membership in that club at the time. And then I started my home layout 7 years ago, and the things that I was building were more and more like Penn Central in New York State, and Lehigh Valley and whatever else I could come up with. And it seemed kind of out of place on a blog that was about Sudbury, CP Rail and Sudbury. And so eventually I decided to split them out. So the other blog is just sort of dormant. It's just sitting there so that people can refer back to, you know, honestly, a lot of the reason that I blog is just to keep track of myself, like just to keep, how did I build that again? Oh, it's on my blog.
Oh, tell me about it. I can't tell you how many times I've gone back to an old article and I think, how did I ever do that? You know, and if you haven't done it since, you know, use it or lose it, right? So that I've done that many, many times. Sometimes I can even remember which article it is.
Yeah. And so that's why there's two blogs.
Well, I'm going to be posting the link to each of your blogs on the podcast group.
Nice.
And I would encourage people to check it out. Now, you have a Facebook group also as well, do you? Remind me.
The Facebook group that I have is for the Hindsight 2020 virtual RPM thing.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
And maybe you could just kind of plug that a little bit too.
Yeah. So back in June, or back, I guess it started back in May when we, Ted Collada is a good friend of mine. Ryan Mendel, those two guys, they manufacture resin kits, right?
Right.
And so I got to know those guys through the various RPMs that I was attending. Ted kind of became, I guess, my roommate at some of these, you know, events. And so we started to stay in touch, et cetera. And then COVID happened and St. Louis, well, first Northeast and then St. Louis got canceled. And we talked about, you know, what could we do to sort of, maintain a sense of community. And so we decided we'd give it a try. Back in June, we did an RPM that takes place on Zoom and you have to register, but it's free. And we have 10 clinics and we thought, well, we'll just run this and see how it goes. And it went well.
How many people were able to participate?
With 10 clinics and 250 attendees approximately.
Yeah, no, that's, like that. I would call that a big success, especially for a first effort.
Yeah. So we did it again in August and we had 300. We did it again in September. I think we had, probably about 350. And then we just did, or we're doing one again next Saturday. And so I think we're at about the same amount of registrants again for this one. And I sort of do some of the moderating. I'm going to be actually presenting first, it looks like. I'm just looking at the schedule now. I'll be presenting as well. But we, you know, a lot of it started off as the steam era resin builders, that core group of people that are, you know, that are the RPM attendees, especially outside of Northeast, right? A lot of the RPMs are the sort of steam era car guys. And I've been working on finding people who have different, interests, modeling interests, so that there's some diversity. And the feedback that I've gotten from everybody is that they quite like seeing and hearing about things that are outside of their normal modeling.
They really like to hear from people who are actually doing something.
Yeah.
It's inspiring. Sure. And yeah. How can you not learn from somebody who's actually modeling?
Yeah. So we've got one layout tour kind of thing. Tom Johnson is on. He's going to give us an overview of his old layout from Indiana.
I actually saw that in person. It was amazing.
Yeah, I was there a couple times. It's a beautiful layout. Tom and I have been friends for a few years, which is interesting because I hardly know many people in the hobby, but I know Tom.
You know what? I think this is one of those, you heard of the 6 degrees of separation. I think in the model railroading world, it's more like two.
Yeah.
Either know somebody or somebody who knows somebody.
Yeah, because it's only so big, right? Like this, it's a lot, it's a much smaller world than I would have ever imagined.
Yep.
Now that I've sort of gotten around with at the RPMs and stuff, you know, I've gotten to know that it's a lot of the same faces.
That's right. When I was going to all of them that couple of years there, there were the locals, and then there were the people that traveled everywhere, and we were always together in the bar on a Saturday night, you know.
Yeah, it's good people.
Yeah,
good people. So that's the hindsight thing. Hey, did we tell everybody about my name? Did we do that? I can't remember.
No, we didn't. But we should make sure that people aren't confused. So
because they're gonna go to my blog and they're gonna go, "Who's Hunter Hewson?"
Exactly. Right? I mean, I had the same problem. So you know, if I can have the problem, anybody can have. Right?
So I presented at Northeast, and I met one of the guys that I met at Northeast. I think the first time I was there, he's in some kind of like finance world, sort of big time industrial leasing or something like that. Right. And I introduced myself as Jerry, and then, you know, we start talking, and my friend and one of the guys says, "Your clinic is at this time," or whatever. He looks at the thing and he goes, "No, Hunter Hewson is on at that time." And I went, "No, that's me." And he goes, "What's the deal with that?" So I explain it to him. and the funny thing is that, like, this is a thing. So he says, "Well, I do the same thing, right? Like I can't have like a digital footprint that, confusing in my business."
Right.
So when people Google me, they have to find, you know, the thing that I do. They can't find that. So they won't find his family stuff. They won't find anything else. And in the music business, the same thing happens. A lot of people don't realize this, is that, you know, I'm friends with some, you know, really famous people who have names on Facebook. They, you know, they'll have their official persona, you know, social media, and then they also have like an alter ego, so that nobody can bug. They can be a normal person on Facebook then, right? They can be just,
I know several people like that,
right? So, or not just Facebook, but Instagram and sure. Or they'll have a blog.
What's the
or
difference?
Something. Yeah, whatever. It's all, you know, but the thing is, so this guy, his name is Mike, and he says to me, he's in my clinic, the one that I think it was the same one that you attended. And afterwards he goes, and I always explain this to people, right? Like when I introduce myself, cause not a lot of people knew me at that point in time. I don't think a lot of people know me now, but regardless, I explain what the deal is with that. Right.
Well, you're going to get the podcast bump, Jerry. So, you know,
well, there we go. Yeah. I'm going to have to practice my autograph signing again. Right? It's been a while. So he goes, you know, you could have heard a pin drop when you said that, you know, that you're doing that. Cause I guess he was like, you know, I think maybe you freak people out, because they're not used to, you know, hearing about people having a second kind of, you know, internet presence. So
makes it seem like, you know, your other job is the NSA or something, you know.
Well, that's exactly what he was getting at, right? Like I'm in the CIA or something,
right?
No, Hunter Street and Houston Street in Hamilton is the headquarters of the THMB.
Oh, that's where it comes from.
And when I started in the hobby, and I started that blog, that first blog on day 30, or whenever it was. I can't remember now what day it was. But I started that blog, and I was like, well, I gotta come up with, you know, because I was already doing a lot of online promotion of various, you know, music business things and et cetera, right? We've already talked about that. And I thought, well, I gotta find a place to park this blog. And I thought, well, you know, Hunter and Houston Streets are like, it's obvious to anybody from Hamilton that Hunter Hewson is not a real person's name.
Okay.
Because any trained person from Hamilton understands what Hunter and Hewson Street is.
Gotcha. And
at that moment, 30 days into the hobby, I had no idea that I would ever interact with anybody beyond Hamilton in the hobby. And I had no real sense of how, like, that I, you know, could be friends with people in Belgium and stuff, right? So nor did I think that it would be necessary or something that would be interesting, right? And so then I start getting interested in writing more articles, and then, you know, I meet people from around the world, and then I've got this kind of awkward moment where it's like, well, that's not my real name, but, you know, nobody calls me Hunter. You can call me Jerry, that's my real name, but over on the interwebs, my footprint is left behind by Hunter Hewson. And that's
got it.
And that's why I, when I started doing articles, I think I've got, like, I think I have 5 appearances in Craftsman now.
Okay. And they're under the Hunter.
Yeah. And yeah. I thought, you know, this makes more sense because the blogs are there, you know, under Hunter. And also, you know, for the same reason is that the digital footprint all lines up now. Right. So.
Well,
that's why. That's
your
all.
Your secret's out now, Jerry. So the man's
name is... It was never
is...
a secret, right? It was an open secret.
The so. Man's name is Jerry Schaefer, a.k.a. Hunter Hewson. And I hope people will check out his blogs, which I'll be posting on the podcast.
Can I ask Jerry? You a question, Mike?
Absolutely.
Before we sign off, Beatles or Rolling Stones?
Beatles.
Good man. Ginger or Marianne?
Ask me on different days and you'll get a different answer.
Okay, fair enough. Scotch or bourbon?
Ooh, don't like the hard liquors.
Okay. Monopoly or Scrabble?
Oh, Scrabble.
Right on. Okay, I got a better sense of who Mike Rose is now.
I hope I passed. And you didn't mention Stratego, but I loved Stratego too.
I don't know what that is. I'm gonna have to look that up.
I'm dating myself here. Jerry, it was great talking with you. Have a great night.
Likewise, Mike. See ya.